You're with ABC Radio National Summer, and welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner here with you. Glad to have your company. Today we're celebrating a little-known link in the annals of seafaring history between two very distant places, Port Victoria in South Australia and the Åland Islands in the Baltic Sea between Sweden and Finland. In the 1890s, improvements in the design of engines made the steamship a much more efficient cargo mover than the old sailing ships. As the death knell was sounding on the tall ships, the Åland Islander, Gustav Eriksson, built up the last great cargo-carrying sailing fleet the world would ever see. In today's program, The Last of the Cape Horners, Franz Doherty tells the story of these ships, the men who sailed them, and what must have been the most exciting and dangerous open sea race the world would ever see.
Around Cape Horn we've got to go, long time ago. Around Cape Horn to Callao, long time ago.
I said to my mother, I wonder what it would be like to go and sail in one of these old sailing ships. And most mothers would say, of course, you know, well, there's no way you're going to find out.
We're not living from minute to minute, hour to hour. We're living from second to second.
You're aloft, and I recall when I came down, and others the same, with the back of our oilskins torn to shreds from the hailstones, the big hailstones hitting us.
Had I been able to, I think, jump overboard and swim ashore or jump on a boat, I no doubt would have done it. But there was no way, of course, of being able to swim ashore. I was on that ship and that's where I was going to stay for 4 months.
I liked the sailing ships because they were clean. No waste, there was no air pollution, no noise pollution, and the wind was free.
After the First World War, Europe needed grain to feed its war-torn population, and Australia produced more grain than it needed. The grain trade between Australia and Europe became the last trade left to the tall ships. Gary Kerr is a professional fisherman, documentary maker, author, and historian.
The last fleet of sailing ships in the world was owned by Gustav Eriksson in the Åland Islands of Finland. And about the only cargo left to these ships was a carriage of grain from Port Victoria in South Australia to Europe, mostly by way of Cape Horn. You have this amazing link with these two little places at the opposite ends of the world, even today. If you go to Murrayham, you'll see the taxi plates are named after the old ships that sailed in the 30s and 40s. And if you go to Port Victoria in South Australia, you'll see the streets are named after some of the sailing ships. You've got Law Hill Street, Passat Street, Viking Street, Pamir Street, and so on. These big sailing ships that were sailing in the 1930s and 40s, they were the peak of hundreds of years of evolution of the sailing ships. They were built in the 1890s and early 1900s to compete against steam.
If it wasn't for Gustav Eriksson, the tall ships would have died out long before 1949. After the First World War, the Germans were forced to hand much of their shipping over to the Allies, including an impressive fleet of tall ships. Eriksson seized the opportunity to buy these windjammers at scrap prices. Gunn Eriksson Herling is the granddaughter of Gustav Eriksson and still runs his shipping business in the Åland Islands.
He loved sailing ships. He used to compare a sailing ship with the full sails, swelling sails, with a pregnant woman. And he thought that was the two most beautiful things in the world. And there's so much emotions, too, when you see a pregnant woman. So you can just applicate these emotions he had also on the sailing ships. But also he was a very good businessman.
Tor Lindquist was born in Finland and now lives in Melbourne. He's probably the most experienced Cape Horner alive today. He was in square-rigged ships for 8 years and sailed around Cape Horn 6 times.
I was a dropout from high school. And I didn't want to go back to school. So I said to my dad, I want to ship out. And I went to Gustav Eriksson's office and asked for a job. But it was too late for that season. So he said, you can have a job next year when the ships return from Australia.
He was able to compete because his operating costs were so low. And he was also able to compete against steam because time was not of the essence. He could afford to lay about in little anchorages like Port Victoria, Wallaroo, Port Pirie, and take a long time to load because of his low overhead costs.
We sailed in late September from Mariehamn, and we got down to Copenhagen for stores and water. And then we sailed from there into the North Sea. Our best day's run in the Passat was just over 330 nautical miles. And that was down somewhere between the Cape of Good Hope and Australia.
Well, some of the young Finns who joined these ships to sail out to Australia, they'd had quite enough of sailing ships by the time they got to Port Victoria with the rigours and hardships of onboard sailing ship life. And they jumped ship in Australia. And their places were taken by young Australians who had no idea what they were letting themselves in for. There was a young Australian by the name of Alan Villiers who signed on one of these ships for a voyage to Europe. He went again a few years later in the Grace Hawa, and he wrote a book about that voyage by way of Cape Horn. And then he went in the Herjigan Cecilia and he wrote a book about that called Falmouth for Orders. He wrote articles for National Geographic magazine and he wrote newspaper articles. And these articles inspired young people to do what he was doing, to experience this last great adventure of the great sailing ships.
Eriksson's two ships, the Pamir and the Passat, were the last commercial sailing ships to round Cape Horn. The year was 1949, and Keith McCoy crewed on the Pamir.
My great-grandfather was a sea captain, and his father was a sea captain and so on, so maybe it was in me to feel some urge in that way. As a result of that, I went over there for a holiday to just have a look at them. One day, I was in the caravan and looking out the back window, and I said to my mother, I wonder what it would be like to go and sail in one of these old sailing ships. And most mothers would say, of course, you know, well, there's no way you're going to find out. You're not going on one of those things. But my old mum was an incredible woman, and as far as anything like that is concerned, go and find out.
Chris Halls crewed on the Passat in 1949.
I wanted to be Cape Horner. I heard about being around Cape Horn on the Windjammer. I had a good job. I'd give that job up if I could get an application on the Windjammer. I remember a Friday where the agent in Adelaide said, we've got an application for you. We eventually got round to Port Victoria. They had a doctor around here who sort of gave you a quick examination to see whether you're fit or not, because it was a job which needed fitness and teamwork, and you couldn't have a bad heart or anything like that on board a Windjammer.
Well, the local policeman at Beachport was transferred to Port Victoria, and he and my father were great mates.
Maurice Corigliano joined the Passat crew in 1948.
And he wrote and said that he could get me a position on the Passat, that he was friendly with the captain, if I wanted to do so. And so I did.
My brother and I got on the old motorbike that we had over there, the old Harley Davidson, and scrambled back to Adelaide and went in to see the agents on Monday morning, and they said, have you got a passport? And I said, no. So I got passports and I got clothes and, you know, waterproofs and all that sort of thing.
The small town of Port Victoria in South Australia took on a new lease of life when the Windjammers were in. Tourists would come to see these unique ships and the men that sailed them. Alison Gibson, now 89, is a resident of Port Victoria and has fond memories of these ships in port.
Oh, I think we all enjoyed, you know, mixing with them, and we used to have frequent trips out to the ships. They'd send a motorboat in and take a crowd of us out there, and or otherwise we'd go out with one of the fishing boats and... You know, it gave everybody an interest because people would come, you know, from far and near to see them because they were so, you know, rare. Like even in those days, they only came to two or three ports.
Port Victoria, my first impression of it was the end of the world. Nothing much there. It was one pub, one cafe, and one shop and a post office and one policeman, that was all. And it wasn't a very interesting port compared to Hamburg and the big ports in Europe. And all we could do there was go and have a glass of beer, or two, or three.
Anyway, we came out to the Port Victoria Hotel here, and I was amazed that some of the crew were ashore, and chief knifed in their belts, berets on their hats, and sea boots on, and they're having a wonderful time in the Port Vic Hotel. The chief mate was there. He's a wonderful, wonderful seaman at sea, but he was there. He could lift a table up in the Port Vic Hotel with his teeth and stand at right angles, put himself at right angles to a pole in the bar, at right angles with his muscles. Have you ever tried that? For God's sake. Anyway, these are the sort of blokes I had a quick impression in the front bar.
When the crew came in off the ships to a ball and the suppers that were put on, we used to have marvellous suppers here. They were renowned everywhere, you know, and of course these boys would just love them, you know, and they'd go back over onto the board again and look forward to the next ball and they'd be in again. When the boys came in off the ships, they'd come to the balls and they'd be all standing in the doorway, and when the music would start, they'd march up the centre of the hall and turn and bow. Well, you never knew for sure which one they were bowing at, but someone would get up, you know, and dance with them, and half the time they'd have heavy boots on, which were not good on the floor, but anyway, they still managed to get around. We used to have pictures every week, sometimes twice a week. We'd all be in the hall watching a picture, and all of a sudden somebody would come in the front door and say, "It's on." And all the men in the hall would get up and walk out, and we'd all be left in there. The German boys were very quiet and nice. Well, most of the Finnish ones were too, but unfortunately, some of them would get into a bit of a fight with some of the catch hands. They used to do all right.
It took us about 6 weeks to load. The little catches used to bring out the weight from the jetty to the ship. We were about 4 miles offshore. And they were loaded very slow going. We used our own winches. We could only lift about 3/4 of a ton at a time. And the wheat lumpers stored the cargo in the hold.
You know, it created a lot of interest and, of course, created a lot of work.
Shore boat was going back, taken out with a little pop-pop motor on the small boat. They couldn't go. They had pigs that escaped. They'd been tied up with rope yarn around the legs, but someone didn't tie them correctly, and there was seamen tearing along the beach here at Port Victoria trying to catch these pigs, pouncing on them, you know, and I thought that was a bit strange. These blokes trying to pounce on these pigs. Anyway, we eventually got them on, and we went aboard.
They threw all the gear up there when the dory boat came into the jetty to get me. And there I was, a stranger, knew nothing about the ship. No, I didn't even know the names of the sails in order.
Before we left Australia, and the hatches were well belted down and canvassed over and so on, etc., and the life nets were strung up. And I remember thinking at the time, gee whiz, that's high, you have a life net up as high as that, you couldn't jump up to get it. But I realised these experienced Swedes and Finns, they knew all about Cape Horn,
Yes, we used to batten down the hatches, and the hatches were so well battened down that if the ship had turned upside down, they wouldn't have come adrift. And that's the way they stayed until we got to port. No, the hatches didn't leak. The decks would leak sometimes, the wooden decks, especially in the low hill. They had rotten decks and they leaked.
Next morning, I then just got used to my bunk, put my things inside. Next day, I had to go out on deck and start learning all about all that I could. And that was the Friday. Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, we set sail. And as a result of that, I started learning what to do, where to go. And being on my own, of course, and a stranger, I was a very, very lonely boy.
The men not only risked their lives delivering cargo, but faced the added challenge of ensuring their ship made the fastest time back to Europe.
I'm sure it was Alan Villiers, through his writing, who coined the term the grain races. I don't think we can underestimate the influence Alan Villiers had on publicising the grain races to the rest of the world. It wouldn't have happened without Gustav Eriksson, and few people would have known about it if Villiers hadn't publicised it. So you have these two people, Eriksson the ship owner and Villiers the publicist.
Yes, the grain races became important to him, I think partly because it was a local big interest for the sailing ships. Actually, the grain races became famous without his participation. But of course, once that it was a hit, he was thrilled to be competing.
They didn't all start on one day, of course. They sailed when they loaded. It could be weeks, several weeks, between the first of them left and the last of them set sail. So these so-called races were actually gauged on elapsed time, the amount of days that elapsed between leaving Australia and arriving in Cork and Ireland or Falmouth in England. These vessels could take anything from 83 days up to 140 or 50 days to complete the voyage, depending on what sort of a run they had and what sort of luck they had with the wind. These were big ships. They were 3 and 4,000 tonne. They were the biggest sailing ships ever built. They were built of steel, had steel masts and steel rigging. The mast was as high as an 18-storey building. In fact, when the Pamir came into Sydney in 1934 to load grain, they had to lower the topmast to get under the Sydney Harbour Bridge.
You were given no chance to find your sea legs within 24 hours of going aboard the Passat up aloft. No, can you, are you frightened or anything, up aloft. And you went right to the very top.
195 feet up, over the ratlines, up the cross trees, and up again, more cross trees, up the royals. I said to myself at that stage, I've got to do it.
When I started climbing up the top there, I had no idea really what I was letting myself in for. I didn't know how to climb out on what they call the futtock shrouds, which is the first set out on the cross trees, and you had to climb out underneath that and then up the next lot and then underneath the gallants and on from there. Had I been able to, I think, jump overboard and swim ashore or jump on a boat, I no doubt would have done it, because I thought, well, if I've got to get up this mast, this high and this awkward down south in the rough conditions that are going to be obviously be down there, I don't need that. But there was no way, of course, of being able to swim ashore. I was on that ship and that's where I was going to stay for 4 months.
You're with Hindsight on ABC Radio National, and I'm France Doherty. Up until the First World War, crews were tough, hard old sea dogs who frequented whorehouses from Bristol to San Francisco. In the 1920s, things changed. Young men who needed to get their time in sail in order to qualify for their maritime certificates joined the crews.
Through his books and writings, Alan Villiers enthused others. He even had women going on these sailing ships. They even paid passage to go. They could have gone much more comfortably in steamships, but they could see that this was one adventure that they were never going to get the chance to repeat again.
Daphne Villiers, the wife of Alan Villiers, kept a diary when she journeyed with Alan on the Palmer in the 1932 grain race.
Thursday, March 17. To sea. We sailed at evening in bright moonlight with a starry sky. No flags, no ballyhoo and no onlookers. we were anchored 8 miles out. We left at 8 p.m. I being at the wheel with Alan, it was a great moment when the boys set the sails, a sight I shall never forget.
A sextant and a clock. That was their only navigational aids. They had an old wireless they could receive when they got a little bit close to land, but there was no transmitting sets. So, they did a tremendous job.
We had a whaleback wheelhouse made of steel. That was very good protection for the helmsman. And you couldn't see behind you. You couldn't look at the big seas coming up and get frightened. Like some helmsmen got frightened and ran away from the wheel. We couldn't see that. And we never got wet there in rain, except when we were close-hauled. Close-hauled steering by the wind was easy. You barely touched the wheel. Very easy. Running before the wind was very hard work. In freezing weather, we used to sweat. You never stopped spinning the wheel. And the wheel from harder port to harder starboard was 27 turns of a big wheel. We were over 6 foot diameter wheel. Steering is an art. You learn to steer.
We've had company again today. Beating through Bass Strait at the northeast of Tasmania, we thought at first it was Alma Doppel, but she had too much square sail. She was a big ship, a Cape Horn grain racer, like ourselves. We were surprised to see her, as the captain had figured out this way as a shortcut. The captain watched her all day like a cat does a mouse, seeking to outdo her for the lead.
We got down off Tasmania and we had a heading of the wind. So we were quite a while, 4 or 5 days I think it was, off the west coast of Tasmania, waiting for the wind so we'd get around the bottom and go down to the roaring 40s and go on from there.
It's around Cape Horn where I must go. Touch, chase the whales through the frost and snow.
There were two routes back to Europe. One was via the Cape of Good Hope, where they sailed westward across the Great Australian Bight, up into the Indian Ocean to pick up the southeast trade winds, around the Cape of Good Hope and up into the Atlantic. It was a friendly route, not too many storms, but it was a slower route. The fastest route was to go from South Australia, sail south, below Tasmania, below New Zealand, into the roaring 40s and howling 50s, on the treacherous road to Cape Horn.
Yes, around Cape Horn I've got to go. For that is where the whale fish blow.
It was the winter time, which made things much worse. Sometimes you can get a pretty fair wind and a pretty fair trip, and we had a bad trip.
One stage down there in the big seas, and when I say big seas, nobody can really comprehend how big they are unless, honestly, they have been down and experienced. These boys that go down to the polar business and that, they would have a pretty good idea what it's like. The waves can be anything up to 3/4 of a mile in between the crests and the crests, and the big swells and with there, they have 3 huge waves on top of them.
On the Passat, we had strong gale up to hurricane force, and we were running before that. The sea were very big, and you could see the stern lifting high, and we would surf down into the trough of the sea, and we used to watch the sails, and the main upper topsail would hang slack when the ship was in the trough, and the main upper topsail was about 100 feet above the water. So you can imagine the size of the seas. We had lifelines rigged all along the deck, both sides. We had life nets above the bulwarks on both sides, so we wouldn't get washed over. And we shipped a lot of heavy seas. The decks would be full between the bulwarks, and I reckon there would be over 500 tons of water on deck.
They'd get pushed further south trying to get wind, you know, the right winds, and of course then you've got the threat of icebergs.
Captain Bjorgfelt was a master seaman. Most of those Scandinavian captains were just fantastic as far as using those old sailing ships the way in which they should be used. They knew the sea, they knew. At one stage there, the old man came up and he was snoopering around like this sort of thing. We wondered what the heck was he snooping around. He could smell ice. Being late in the year like that, it was quite possible for ice to be in that area. Well, 3 days later, one of our ABs was up the mast and he yelled out, "Icebergs!" And sure enough, the old man shot out and he even went up partway up the Ratlins, which is the equivalent to the ladder, as we call it, on land. Looked out and there were 2 icebergs. They were not close, but they were certainly a little way off, real from the point of view that being halfway between New Zealand and the Horn, goodness knows how many icebergs were around at the time. So a double watch was put on straight away, of course, up on the forecastle, which was, to say, a bit terrifying to be up there pacing backwards and forwards, and one up on the cross trees looking for the ice.
Well, all those vessels were undermanned. They were really designed for about 80-man crew, all told. We had, all told, captain and everyone, 34. So they were grossly undermanned. And at the end of their life, they were trying to maintain them in a seaworthy condition, but skimping as much as they possibly could to try and make them pay. And everything, like, for example, not that this wasn't the pattern to a large degree anyway, but navigation lights, they wouldn't put kerosene in them when they were down in the real southern latitudes. Why worry? There's no one here, and you were charging through the water there with no navigation lights at all, just to save kerosene.
Sometimes we were on deck for 24 hours non-stop. I only got a bit of cold food to eat.
Of course, we understaffed, 10 in each watch. And to take 2.5 acres of canvas in, it was a terrible. There was a fight on two on board to jolly well get rid of tensions and things.
We used to wear oilskins, but they were a hindrance. And I didn't like to wear oilskins. I rather got wet. So I used to get run aloft without oilskins, without worrying about the rain or hail or snow. And I remember my shirt used to blow off my back. And we got the hail on the back and snow. And there would be ice on the yardarm, on the jackstay. And that's what you hang on to. And it was cold and slippery. Oh, looking back on it, it was very dangerous. And when you're out on the yardarm furling a sail, it's not like fighting a dead thing. The sail is fighting back and trying to knock you off the yardarm. It bellies right up and tries to push you off. Sometimes you have to get right under it and sit down on the foot drop to avoid it. Sometimes if we were over 2 hours up there, all hands, the yardarm would be full of men.
Well, in those southern latitudes and ice and snow, you're aloft. And I recall one time when I came down, and others the same, with the back of our oilskins torn to shreds from the hailstones, the big hailstones hitting us. There was no point in wearing gloves. You never ever dreamt of that. And the sails would be stiff and cold and so forth with the ice and the cold. And whilst it didn't happen to me, it happened to other men aboard. You're trying to furl the sail and it would blow back and out would come fingernails.
We used to get what you call sea cracks on the sides of your finger. You get deep cracks and the salt water gets in there and it hurts like hell. And we used to try and wash our hands and put Vaseline in, but that didn't help. The best remedy was urine on your hands and on your neck, where you had oilskin chafe on your neck. That was good medicine. On the second voyage in the Passat, we were taken in the crojack, or a crossjack, as some people call it. The whole watch was on the yardarm. We were about eight men. I was there amongst them, and I was holding on the gasket, trying to get the gasket tight, and there was a bit of slack somewhere, and I went backwards. And before I knew it, I was hanging from the foot rope with my arms. And I quickly swung my legs up on the foot rope, and the two guys on each side of me grabbed hold of me and pulled me up, and we just carried on furling the sail regardless, nothing. But when I got down on deck later on, I got a bit of a shock, because falling down would have been certain death, and I would have fallen on deck. So somebody up there looked after me. When you went aloft, you were on the foot rope, there was no back rope, there was no safety net like they have in a circus. No safety harness, and they were unheard of. Wouldn't have wanted them anyway. This was our safety harness, strong arms.
We killed our biggest pig today, and to my horrible amazement, at tea, reclining in a place of honour on the table, was its liver. I'm afraid I made a great faux pas by declining it, with thanks. The He-Men soon made short work of it.
They took a couple of pigs to give them a bit of fresh meat, and they were eventually slaughtered, and that would be a story in itself, how they usually muck that up. Eventually they'd shoot the pig. They'd try and cut its throat, and the pig would escape, and goodness only knows what. But then the big event was to catch its blood, and you'd have blood pancakes, which the Swedes really thought was good. And actually, I didn't mind them, but there were other Australians aboard, and they just couldn't face up to a blood pancake. But they were good. And the they had bread. It's a little bit like, some of our hard biscuits today, Kanaka bread, it was in their language. And they would bring it out of the hold and get it on deck, and they would knock all the weevils out. And that's what you would have for bread. And, you'd need sharp teeth, I can tell you. And they took a fair bit of tin stuff and that from Australia. No, I didn't mind the food, but I'm just an old fisherman.
The food wasn't really rationed. We could get any amount of salt horse, but we couldn't eat it. It was awful. Very few of us could eat it. And we used to go down during the night where the salt horse was stored on the tween decks up forward, and get it up on deck and dump it over the side. But there was so much of it, we couldn't win. There was plenty of potatoes and onions, but getting into the tropics, they would rot, so we had to throw them away. And we had plenty of pea soup. We had dried fish, dried cod. It was as hard as a rock. But when it was soaked and cooked, it was very nice. That was about the best food we had, dried cod.
You were constantly wet. You just couldn't stay dry, and you couldn't stay warm. I've heard other Cape Horners, Australians actually, say that they were so cold that they peed in a bottle and took the bottle to bed to try and warm their feet. So that's the kind of, the desperate acts you get to. You'd be so tired and so cold and so long without sleep that it didn't matter that your bunk was saturated. You'd curl up and hoping to get some sleep, and you could hear the whistles. The one whistle, it's still in my mind today. I can hear it as I'm talking now. The one whistle, porpoise, two whistle, not my watch, three whistle, the dreaded three whistle, all hands on deck. And as I say, it's with me today. I hear it still.
Round Cape Horn we've got to go, long time ago. Round Cape Horn to Callao, long time ago.
Friday, April 15th. Plenty of snow today. I went on deck this afternoon just as the snowstorm began. It was a very lovely sight. The ship rolling along under all sail and the snow falling. But it was not so pleasant for the two boys who were working on the upper T'Gallant yard.
The wind has hit the Andes and the South America. They can't go over the top. the wind has to hit the Andes and go round into Drake's Passage. What was it, that sort of wind, going circumnavigating the world, there's no continent in between, they howl down there, the rigging is howling, the snow and ice is falling on these bleak storms that are coming up from the Antarctic and in the Southern Ocean. We saw ice we've never seen before. We saw snow that half of us never saw before in our lives. Just seeing the footprints in the snow.
Wednesday, April 16th. The captain says it is the worst storm he has been in for 10 years. Beyond a bruise or two on my arms, I made out okay. The captain has hurt his leg, but he's able to hobble around. The poor apprentices have lost practically everything, home goods and all. It is pathetic to see them today, each one drying what few things he has left.
Abreast of Cape Horn, the ship was... she was in real danger. She only had a little bit of sail up. The ship had heeled over to such a degree and the weather was so bad that you couldn't get aloft to cut that sail free, not without high risk. Although the first mate, who was a superman, toughest man you could ever dream could exist, he was prepared to have a go, but the captain wouldn't let him, because it was near certain that he wouldn't have got there. The captain was so concerned that he called us all on deck and we stood under the forecastle head. I mean, it was just a... what will I say? It was a farce, really, because it was simply say you wouldn't be trapped in the forecastle if the ship capsized, but if you went into the water, you'd be dead in a few minutes. God was looking kindly on us that day, and most of the young crew, they didn't really realise the danger they were in, and I don't think I did either, but when I look back and think about that's why we're under the forecastle head, and the skipper didn't think that boat was going to come out of that.
We have to go up the mast any time of day and night, having to go up there say 2 a.m. in the morning to try and take the top heaviness of the ship off. Because that's the most danger. If she gets top heavy, loaded with ice and snow, you can't actually bring the sails in. They're so frozen stiff. Your nails are bleeding at the wick. Your cheeks are bleeding with the hail. And you're really frozen up there, the wind howling through your oilskins, coming down from having felled the Royal or the Gallant. I had my hands on the backstays to put my feet into the ratlines, and she rolled my way. Say 30 degrees. I just couldn't get my legs into the ratlines. You're hanging there in the dark and just waiting for someone to bring the ship back. next roll, you know, because when she's hanging your way, you're over the ocean 195 feet up, and it's a terrible feeling. I said, "Is this my moment? You've got no feelings in your hands. They're frozen stiff. You don't wear gloves up there, you can't. You've got to have feeling." And she eventually came back. Oh, for goodness sake. It was a terrible time. Some were brought up religious, a lot of us, but some weren't religious at all. But I can tell you, they became very, very religious after a time. We never dreamed we'd ever have a hope of seeing land again. We're not living from minute to minute, hour to hour. We're living from second to second.
And right off Cape Horn, and we could see Cape Horn in the distance, we saw another square rig, and that was the Mushulu. And she had all her sails set, and we had our royals furled. So we quickly set our royals to try and keep up with the Mushulu, but she still beat us.
The superstition was, of course, we're all friends of albatrosses. In the 40 degrees south to 40 degrees south around Cape Horn, we all had to be friends with albatrosses. Sometimes they flew into our sails and landed on the deck. We looked after them and put them away. The superstition was, of course, for every albatross is a sailor who had been drowned around Cape Horn.
Oh, wrap me in my country's flag and lay me in the cool blue sea. let the roaring of the waves my solemn requiem be. And I shall sleep a pleasant sleep while storms above their vigils keep.
Monday, April 18th. Weather seems to be much better today, but we still have plenty of snow and hail. With two more decent days, we should be to the Horn.
It was night time, and being the last commercial square rigger, Pamir, to go around Cape Horn, the first mate, the bosun, and one of the ABs was on the poop, and I just happened to be down below when I heard them say, "We're rounded the Horn." We were 45 days between Port Victoria and getting to Cape Horn. Every one of those three men on the poop are dead. From that point of view, now I am the last one.
Cape Horn lies in 56 degrees south latitude, and it's well south, and there was always a danger of icebergs, especially in the winter. Some sailing ships actually foundered because, presumably, they ran into icebergs. They just simply didn't turn up at their port of destination. But amazingly, Ericsson, with his fleet of 15 ships and the number of years they sailed, he never lost a ship on the Cape Horn Road. They had bad times, but they always saw it through.
Once you turn that corner in the tropics, southeast trade winds, there wasn't a lot of work to do there because the winds blew steadily from the one direction and you didn't have to wear ship or be taking in sails too much. That was a good life.
Tuesday, May 17th. We still have the trades, also some heavy tropical rain. The boys are now changing sail and putting up tropical rags. The hens have begun laying again today, and the bare backs of the boys look like the rising sun.
Day to day, it was getting warmer all the time. What a wonderful experience to have a steady ship. Unbelievable. In those latitudes, completely different. Sand shoes and shorts. You didn't have to put your knees up on the bunk every time she rolled. We could just lie there. And what wonderful thing once we got up near the River Plate, northing more, up towards Rio or somewhere, but you know, a few thousand miles out mid-Atlantic, we get tropical downpours. With the ship steady, we could block the scuppers up, and the water would fill up there and almost have a swimming pool. At last, we can wash our clothes from the Cape Horn, still covered with salt. Our shoes had gone mouldy with the tropics. We heaved everything out. We have folks on each side where the 10 men are. Bunks right round the room and the mess table. That's all we had. Each side, there were different watches. And we pulled everything out and complete places where we sleep and eat, clean up and paint out, varnishing. And what wonderful days.
Yes, in the trade winds, when we had beautiful weather, when I watched below, before we turned in, we used to go up forward and yarn and sing. And we sit on the forward bits. That's why they call these songs Four Bitters. We used to sing mostly Swedish sailor songs, and there was plenty of them. And it was very enjoyable. And some songs we used to make up our own words. I can't repeat them.
Damon were scraping the decks with teak, and regularly we were washing down with buckets over the side. A certain technique to dip that bucket as you're travelling along at 4 or 5 knots. I mean, if you didn't do it correctly, the bucket could take you with it.
We just had a cow of a trip right up to the Falkland Isles, and then it eased off a little bit. But you get up into the southeast trade winds and so forth, and that's why people go back on those ships. They remember the good times, and that was it.
Entertainment was cards. We had a cat aboard, and some used to play with the cat. And, some used to play hide and seek, you know, or chasey up the yards and slide down the gantlers. By that time, we were experienced seamen. We learnt how to work as a team and very confident of whatever we did on board ship. We had a few mouth organs on board. Some would whistle, but it wasn't done on a sailing ship to whistle because being opposition to the mate, it was taboo.
You're with Hindsight on ABC Radio National, and I'm France Doherty. Crossing the equator, or the line, for the first time was a significant event in a sailor's life and something to be celebrated.
Crossing the line ceremony, we didn't really know what to expect, but we were forewarned as to what was going to happen. And next thing is King Neptune, of course, and his courtiers came over the bow and the forecastle head and down into the midship section, and there was the bath, of course, or the christening bath, and each one of us was dragged out of the forecastle to be initiated, to say the least of it, and was sat on the edge of the tub was one of the things we had to do, and look through the binoculars for the equator, which is the line, and of course that consisted of two bottles, and a tape was across that, and without realising it, of course, and we thought, oh, well, we'll look through that, now there's the line sort of thing, but of course the bottles were full of water, and as I put it up, you copped an eye full of salt water, which I suppose cleaned the eyes out a bit, but then when you were nice and steady there, all of a sudden along came one of the soldiers, his courtiers, and pushed you back into the tub. That saturated you. So we were sopping wet there, and then they pulled you out after holding you under for a little while, and they started plastering you with, I won't even mention what the stuff consisted of, but we did have two pigs on board. And the paint, and from the paint locker and all that was left over, and goodness knows how old it was. But anyhow, we looked quite a sight, and all we had on was shorts. And of course, that wasn't always the case with these sorts of things, but because of the women being there, two women, I think that was what they allowed for. But it was quite a messy procedure. But I've got a certificate to say that I'm truly christened as a square rig sailor, showing that, signed by the captain and King Neptune, who happened to be the bosun, as it happens, a true christening.
Reuben Nicolou was Ericsson's top skipper, and he was a very keen sailor man. He won four of the grain races in Ericsson's flagship, the Hertogen Cecilia. But Reuben Nicolou's crowning glory was winning the 1933 grain race in the Palmer. Now, the Palmer was a box. She was built to carry. She wasn't built for speed. But it's a testament to Nicolou's skill that he was able to get her home to England in 83 days. Nicolou made the most of every shift of wind. Up in the Atlantic, they had to cross the equator, which is known as the doldrums. It's a belt of calms and variable winds. And a skipper had to take advantage of all those winds. Every shift in a wind, they might get a puff from one direction for 20 minutes, from another direction for 15. In fact, in the Orland Islands, they said Nicolou could control the wind. But actually, it was his skill and his keenness as a sailorman that he achieved such great results. Once they got up through the doldrums into the southern part of the North Atlantic, they headed to the northwest, and eventually as they got further north, they picked up the westerlies, which took them towards England and home.
Saturday, June 18th. Today, we have cleared the Azores and are on the last stretch to Falmouth.
The most terrifying part of the journey, as far as they were concerned, these are the professionals here, was in the English Channel when fog hit us. And we were days in the Channel, sitting around, not able to move, not able to see anything. You couldn't even see the royals, the fog was that thick. And yet we could hear in the fog thumping of engines, hoping to God that they had radar, because we certainly didn't, and one or two times it was just a black shadow would go past. And we were on the foghorn, which was the old hand pump foghorn, of course, that the old sailing ships had, and there was no trouble in getting volunteers to work that foghorn. And it's the first time I saw any of the experienced AVs and the men that had been sea and were professional seamen, they actually, you could see the red blood in their eyes and red-bloodedness of the worry and looking like this and straining their eyes. It was quite noticeable for a bum like me, to say the least of it.
It was very rough and very slow. It took us 49 days to Cape Horn, and in bad weather nearly all the way. And then a similar time to the line. Altogether, we were 144 days from Port Victoria to Falmouth.
Thursday, June 30th. Pamir made Queenstown yesterday afternoon. Therefore, we consider we have won, as we sailed together from Port Broughton, and Falmouth is 70 miles further to sail.
In 1938, we had 98 days from Australia to Falmouth, and we won the grain race. In 1939, in the Passat, Mosuli won the grain race, yes. And she had 91 days, Australia to England, we had 98 days. And anything under 100 days is very good.
The grain races ran between 1921 and 1949. They were a time trial for the ships sailing from South Australia to England. In the late 20s, the Swedes sponsored the making of a trophy. Between 1933 and 1939, the Passat was consistently the fastest ship, averaging 99 days for the voyage.
This grain race trophy was actually awarded to my grandfather because the Herzogin Cecilia, his really flagship, was the fastest one in the grain races in 1928. And I think it has become famous, and it's very beautiful with the sea lady and the globe and the star with the diamond at the top.
Having failed to win the trophy, the Swedes refused to sponsor another, and the 1928 trophy was the only one to be officially awarded. Ericsson attempted to revive the grain business after the Second World War, but it was clear the era was at its end. By 1950, the grain races were over forever. Never again would a cargo-carrying, engine-free sailing ship and its crew fight for their lives against the treacherous Cape Horn.
I liked the sailing ships because they were clean. There was no waste, there was no air pollution, no noise pollution, and there was no pollution at all, and the wind was free, and that's the way I looked at it.
No electricity, no communication with the world. We are men just with the elements and with nature.
It no doubt made, when I say a man of me, it certainly gave me a different perspective on life and what it was all about. And I learnt a lot from that, which certainly was an advantage later in life, probably not even realising, but looking back on it now that I'm, 75 years of age, looking back on it, it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. I'm glad I didn't jump overboard at the beginning and try to swim ashore.
Young Australians that went on those ships after the war, they'd had perhaps 5 or 6 years in the services. And I've often said to them, why are you so fascinated and pay so much attention to your Cape Horn days? And their reply was, lots of other people were in the services, but in the Cape Horn it was, unique.
You've been listening to The Last of the Cape Horners. It was produced by Belinda Bradley and Franz Doherty, and the sound engineer was Louis Mitchell. You heard the voices of Gary Kerr, Gunn Eriksson Herling, Tor Lindquist, Keith McCoy, Chris Halls, Maurice Colliano, and Alison Gibson. Readings were by Sally Jensen. Special thanks to Gary Kerr for the use of the material from his DVD documentary in this program, and it was made with assistance from the ABC's Regional Production Fund.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.